Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take for Pakistan to achieve a unified, stable identity and to reform its nominal democracy into a system that truly empowers its citizens? The Pakistani government has an extensive history of shifting relationships with Islamic militant groups who have been seen as important potential proxies against India and against Soviet forces during the occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. But long-tolerant Pakistani leaders are finding these independent militant groups increasingly intractable, to the extent that some factions may pose an existential threat to the stability of the Pakistani government itself. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela, welcome to Think.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
I want to talk about your subtitle here. We all know there is not a civil war taking place in Pakistan. Talk about the ways in which the country is, though, in fact, at war with itself.
Well, I would say almost in every way except militarily, so to speak. There are cultural tensions, there's religious tensions. There's a real sort of almost a schizophrenia in terms of, you know, how the country sees itself. It has a number of really basic issues it has never resolved since it was formed abruptly from India and wrenched apart from India in 1948. And some of those issues have carried on to this day. But the issue that I deal with primarily in the book and the reason for that subtitle is that I say there's a war going on really for the soul of Pakistan, you know, particularly in terms of religion. You know, the great majority of Pakistanis are Muslims, and the great majority of those are Sunni Muslims. And what's happening today in Pakistan, as well as in other parts of the Muslim world, are that there is this enormous conflict, which is growing rapidly, between the more moderate and tolerant strains of Islam and the more punitive and radical strains of Islam. And in Pakistan, that has played out in a number of ways, not only because of the problems of things like suicide bombings and terrorist attacks, but also in the way people think and the way they feel and how they define their religion and how they define themselves as Muslims and what that means for them. So it's a struggle that is far from over. It's not exactly black and white. You could say there's a continuum of religious views within Pakistan. You know, on the one end you would have the Sufis, which are the more mystical sort of personal notions of Islam that's really between you and God, so to speak, and very tolerant of other religions and other views. And then on the other extreme you have the Taliban types, the sort of Middle Eastern influenced groups that are very radical in their thinking, that don't think women and men should ever be together even anywhere unless they're married, and that have a very punitive view of how religious rules should be carried out. And then somewhere in the middle, you could say, it probably are the great majority of people. But, you know, the events are happening so fast, and there's so much violence and so much struggle that I think it's very hard for many people now in Pakistan to define exactly where they do come out on this issue of what kind of Islam they want for the future of their country.
Well, you mentioned that there are probably in the middle, the largest group of Pakistanis, in fact, continue to practice a relatively moderate form of Islam. But what has fueled the growth of extremist fundamentalism in the past couple of decades?
A number of things. It started out really as a product of the war between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan in the 1980s. That's when the Americans and the Saudis and other international groups worked with Pakistan to create militias that would work with the Afghans to defeat the Soviets. And that was a very successful mission. And unfortunately, it didn't go away. You still had all these new, vigorous, sort of more conservative Islamic groups that had been formed, that were getting donations from overseas. And the Americans and the West essentially pulled out of the region once the Soviets were defeated. And what they left behind was the increasing influence of these Middle Eastern-based, often Saudi-funded groups that were preaching a much more radical version of Islam, I think, than many people realized at the time. So that was sort of the birth of it all. And what's happened in more recent years was that, particularly after the American invasion of Iraq, after 9/11, after continued conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, you had this growing influence of more radical clerics and groups in Pakistan that basically preached that the West is against us. The West is out to get us, to destroy our religion and to destroy Muslims and Islam wherever it exists. And that message has gained a lot of popularity in Pakistan, although, again, this is not necessarily a majority view. And it has intensified even more with the new, relatively new, war that's being waged in Afghanistan, which, of course, is right next to Pakistan. They share a long border, a very porous border. There are the same tribes living on both sides of the border. They're the same religion. They have a great deal in common. So you have this war going on next door. And what you have is the Afghans blaming the Pakistanis and the Pakistanis blaming the Afghans for being the source of these Islamic militants waging this war against the Afghan government and its American and NATO defenders. And what's happened is that the Americans have undertaken this very intense campaign of unmanned bombing, missile strikes along the border where they believe there are Islamic militants hiding. These are not carpet bombings. These are targeted missile strikes against individuals, groups, and locations where the Americans believe that Islamic militants actually are. This campaign has been gaining in the last, it started several years ago, but then it's increased and intensified in the past year or two. And it's a campaign that, even though it's pretty much invisible, you know, to most Pakistanis, because it's only taking place in these remote tribal areas along the border, it's extremely controversial within Pakistan. And I say in my book, after interviewing many, many people about this in Pakistan, that it's probably the single greatest factor in turning Pakistani public opinion against the West.
Turning Pakistani public opinion against the West, certainly. How do those U.S. Predator drone attacks within Pakistani borders affect domestic support for the Pakistani government?
You mean among Pakistanis?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's been very difficult. Pakistan has an elected civilian government that has friendly relationships with the United States and most Western countries. And this has made it more and more difficult for the civilian government to maintain its sense of credibility and power with the public. In the history of Pakistan, it's really always been the military that sort of called the shots when it came to defense and security issues and even foreign policy. That continues to be true today. You know, the country is in the middle of a war, essentially, you know, or involved in a war next door Afghanistan. It has its own troubles with Pakistani Islamic militants that we can talk about in a minute. And it maintains a long, long, long Cold War with India next door. Pakistan and India have been adversaries, you know, forever, and that continues to be a major preoccupation for the Pakistan military. So the civilian government, which is a weak government, it's got a weak party system, it has weak democratic institutions, has had a hard time standing up to the strength and the power of the military institution. And because of the current tensions between Washington and Islamabad, or more accurately, Rawalpindi, which is where the army headquarters is, it's been increasingly difficult for the civilians to really run things.
Have those independent military groups and the official Pakistani military, in fact, been effective in checking potential aggression from India? I mean, is there an argument to be made that these independent Islamic groups have been helpful?
Well, I would say, first of all, there really are no independent Islamic groups there. Those who have been fighting against India or within India have always gotten support from the Pakistani military establishment. They don't spring up spontaneously. And yes, you can say in a way they've been successful. They obviously know that they could never defeat India sort of on the battlefield. These are both nuclear armed next door neighboring states.
Yeah.
And they've both, you know, said that they would not attack each other first with nuclear weapons. So what's happened is that you've got this long running guerrilla, low level, low intensity guerrilla conflict along the border that has been a proxy, a substitute for a wider conventional or nuclear war. And yes, the Pakistani-based groups have been very successful in, you know, harassing and sabotaging and causing trouble for Indian authorities and Indian defense forces along the border. We're particularly talking about the Kashmir region, which is this mountainous a region that separates parts of the two countries, where there has been border fighting going on for a very long time, well over a decade. So yes, they've certainly kept the Indians busy.
How effective over the years since the partition has the Pakistani government been in managing provincial tribal rivalries that predated the separation and maybe have been around for centuries?
This remains a big thorn in the side of Pakistan. I mean, in many ways, it's hard to describe Pakistan as a nation, because many Pakistanis, I certainly couldn't say most, but many Pakistanis see themselves, identify themselves first by their ethnic region, ethnicity, or language, rather than as Pakistanis. And so that has always been the case. It continues to be the case. The Punjabis in Punjab continue to dominate the country economically and politically. So you're left with, you know, three other major ethnic groups and a number of smaller ones essentially battling for political space. There have been violent secessionist movements both in Balochistan and also less so, but certainly existing in Sindh, which are two other provinces. And there has been this continued tension. I mean, the ethnic tensions, for example, in a place like Karachi, a city that you might compare otherwise to New York City or Mumbai or Chicago, it's a big, bustling, modern, it's the only really modern city that we would consider in Pakistan, skyscrapers and banks and insurance companies and lots of public transportation, lots of traffic jams. It's a huge city that you can call in one sense. It's also a port. It's a major port in the region, right on the ocean. Bustling, active, dynamic, and yet utterly and in the thrall of this horrible, violent war that's been going on for a long time and keeps getting worse. And this is essentially an ethnic street war between one ethnic group, the Pashtuns, who've migrated from the northwest, and another ethnic group, the Mahajirs, who are settlers who came from India during partition. And so there are other factors involved, but essentially it's an ethnic conflict that has done a great deal of damage to what otherwise would be, you know, Pakistan's number one city. So that continues to be a problem. There have been repeated efforts to try and help. For example, in the Senate, the Senate was sort of set up, the National Assembly, which is like our House of Representatives, mm-hmm. is based on, you know, strict district votes. But the Senate is apportioned, and so it's an effort to try and balance. It has a lot of seats that are quotas, not only for women, but also for various ethnic groups and various districts and provinces. So it's an effort to provide more ethnic balance at the top of government. But that certainly doesn't stop there from being enormous tensions in real daily life.
My guest is Pamela Constable. She's a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. We invite you now to join the conversation. You can do that by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pamela Constable. She's a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. We invite you to be part of this conversation directly by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Pamela, in terms of their relationships to their own constituents, how have Pakistani officials countenanced the, I have to imagine, embarrassment of the raid on the bin Laden compound last spring?
Yes, it's been really difficult. It was a huge humiliation, particularly for the military establishment, not so much for the political establishment, but it was a real blow to the army and to the intelligence services, and there was an enormous amount of, you know, derisive and critical commentary that came out. I mean, it's hard for Westerners to completely understand this, but for a variety of reasons, the army of Pakistan and the military establishment has always been the most respected and the most effective institution in Pakistan. So to see it in this case look either like they were complete idiots and had no idea what was going on, or look like they were colluding in hiding, you know, the world's most wanted terrorist, a figure on whom they clearly had officially been helping the United States try to look for, it didn't leave them with any good choices. And so the reaction in Pakistan, again, to look at it from a Pakistani point of view, the reaction in Pakistan among the public was not at all really, oh, it's great that somebody got rid of Osama bin Laden. It was much more, wait a minute, why did our military and intelligence establishment allow this to happen? Why did they allow the Americans to come in covertly and do this? Number one, why couldn't they do it themselves? And number two, how could they cede national sovereignty, which is a huge issue among the Pakistani public? They see this as a violation of their national sovereignty more than anything else. So that's been a huge backlash, and it continues to this day. And it's essentially, you know, poisoned what was already a very tenuous bilateral relationship, and it's made the public, you know, for the first time in many, many, many years, critical of and more skeptical of its own military institution.
Is it possible at this point from where you sit to suss out how far up the chain of military command knowledge of the bin Laden compound may have gone?
It's impossible to know. I mean, I have not seen or read or heard anything definitive about this. And, you know, I've been asked this question, you know, fairly often in recent days, and what I've been saying is that I would be extremely surprised if it turned out that senior military or intelligence officials knew about this, because I think, you know, as proved, it would be so embarrassing for them to have somebody that notorious living in plain sight, so to speak, right near in the same neighborhood as Pakistan's version of West Point. The humiliation of it would have just been too much for them to tolerate. If anything, you know, it was thought for years that he was hiding in this mountainous border area along the Afghan-Pakistan border. That would have made more sense because, you know, nobody would have known. He would have been very hidden. That is more believable. But to believe that he was hiding in a large militarized city, and that the senior officials knew about it and did nothing about it, I find really hard to believe. On the other hand, there are all sorts of individuals and groups in Pakistan that have either former or unacknowledged or covert relationships with various Islamic militant groups, and some of whom support them. And it's entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that some of these groups, which include people connected to the intelligence community in Pakistan, were aware of it. But so far, there is no, that I know of, public evidence to that effect.
As you know, Pamela, there's in this country at least a small subset of Americans who believe that what we were told about the demise of Osama bin Laden may not, in fact, reflect the truth. Perhaps he was kept alive longer than some have said. Is there similar suspicion within Pakistan, even among just average people listening to these stories?
There have been, you know, as with any situation where you have sort of a violent event that hasn't been completely explained or made public, there are all sorts of rumors and conspiracy theories that abound. I mean, just to digress for a minute, when Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister of Pakistan, was assassinated in December of 2007, that was never solved, and it was blamed on a whole variety of people, and many, many conspiracy theories surfaced, including one that it suggested that her husband had been involved in it, you know, ranging from that all the way to, you know, Islamic terrorists and political groups and the former president, and, you know, it went on, and of course it was never solved. In this case, there have been lots of other rumors going around, none confirmed. There's been this whole idea that the, you know, Americans were sending out fake polio vaccination workers to see if they could, you know, discover information about bin Laden in his neighborhood, which may be true. But there are all sorts of other, you know, rumors. It's been rumored in Pakistan for years that, you know, sort of bin Laden was being secretly kept alive by the Pakistani army only to use as leverage against the West and to get more money for military equipment and support. So that's been out there a long time. Again, you know, there are a lot of rumors, a lot of speculation, but again, I think it's important to note that I have not seen anything that confirms these rumors.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Sarab in Dallas. Hi, Sarab.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I actually follow these things pretty close. I mean, I'm from India, and there's so much of similarity between people in India and Pakistan, and in fact, we all know that Pakistan and India are separated. What I want to know from your guests is, what is the reason behind this deep-rooted enmity between these two countries? Like, why don't they trust each other? I mean, they together can do so much, and I fail to understand. Like, what are they fearing from each other?
Well, thanks for your call. We could probably do a whole hour on this, but maybe you can briefly address that question, Pamela.
Yeah, it's a great question and a very important question. You know, before I lived in Pakistan, I lived in India, and I lived there for several years, and got accustomed to the culture and the food and the language, and then I moved to Pakistan, and I was stunned to discover exactly what you said, how similar they are. And if you close your eyes and you listen to Hindi, and you close your eyes and you listen to Urdu, which is the Pakistani national language, they're almost identical. But if you open your eyes and you read texts in the two different languages, they might as well be from two different planets. So that's just one example of the similarities that tend to be overlooked, not to mention spicy food, which I can't eat in either country. to be serious, I mean, it's a huge issue, and it's an extremely important issue. I would dare say more important for Pakistan, because Pakistan, cannot compete with India. It cannot defeat or destroy India, and it has much more to lose because it's a poorer country with many, many unmet social needs. And much of the reason that Pakistan has not been able to progress more socially and economically is because such a huge portion of its revenues go to the defense budget, and the great majority of that goes to defending what it sees as the need to defend itself against India. So it's really been a much greater drain on Pakistan than on India. That said, it's sort of been a permanent source of tension and unpleasantness for both countries. There have been three border wars fought between the two countries, all of which involved casualties and great expense. It doesn't serve either country to be competing this way. In fact, economic competition would be much healthier than what's been going on all these years. If I had to sort of say a basic explanation, I would say that because India and Pakistan were separated arbitrarily and in a very brief period of time under the British, and because the birth of Pakistan out of India was so chaotic and so bloody and so creating of deep, deep bitterness and enmity. Basically, I don't think Pakistan has ever gotten over that.
Hmm.
And it has continued to see India as an existential threat to its existence. I think many Pakistanis feel like India still doesn't really acknowledge their right to exist. And that's one of the reasons, probably the main reason, that Pakistan is so proud of and possessive of its image as a nuclear power. It's the only thing it has with which it can compete with India in its mind, in the mind of its leaders. And average, ordinary Pakistanis, if you talk to them about Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, you rarely find anyone who has anything critical to say about it. They feel as if it has put Pakistan on the map and on a par with India.
Is the threat from India every bit as dire as Pakistani spending on defense would suggest?
Well, I don't think so. I think India has an interest in keeping Pakistan, off balance, and to sort of contain it as a potential threat. I don't think India has any interest in destroying Pakistan or taking over Pakistan. Again, I think the real competition in that region is economic.
Mm-hmm.
And India is soaring way, way ahead of Pakistan for a variety of reasons in its economic development and its social development, where I think the real future, struggle lies. But, there are people who, there are smart, intelligent people in this country as well as elsewhere who do think that India has an interest in sort of dominating the region and doesn't want Pakistan to be a successful country. But in terms of, military, I can't imagine India ever really attacking Pakistan. So it's a sore in the side of both countries. But again, I think Pakistan has more to lose.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Doug in Dallas. Hello, Doug.
I am looking forward to the future. One of the things that keeps Pakistan in check and keeps us in check with them is this military road that runs up to Afghanistan, through which we supply our troops. Looking forward to the future, how do you think Pakistan will develop or not develop or whatever once that conflict is over there and Pakistan more or less might be turned loose? No more U.S. aid, no more U.S. troops, no more travel down the road. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
It's a very interesting question you raise, although it's got multiple facets. The road itself is not that important. The fact is that a lot of, as he mentions, the great bulk of military and support supplies to Western forces in Afghanistan does come across the border from Pakistan. So that's a very profitable trade route and certainly is important right now. In the long run, if you ask any Pakistani official and really almost any Pakistani person about Afghanistan, they would say that Pakistan has caused more trouble than it's worth to them, that it's been the source of massive refugee exodus over a long period of time that has drained Pakistan's economy. They would say that it brought the drug culture and the war culture and the gun culture into Pakistan after the Afghan-Soviet war as a result of that. They would say that it brought religious extremism, which hadn't been there before. They would give you a long catalog of ills that they would say Afghanistan and its problems have brought Pakistan, which they would just as soon, would go away. So I think that most Pakistanis would just as soon be left alone to sort of wage their own problems. But Pakistan has also, from a strategic point of view, always felt that Afghanistan, which is a much poorer, more rural country with a lot more problems, that it's a place that they want to dominate, that its military and political establishment want to dominate, want to be able to control, and see as a kind of buffer to India, and they call it strategic depth, that it's a country that if they can sort of dominate Afghanistan, that this would help them protect themselves against India. So it's a complicated relationship, but basically I think that most Pakistanis feel that Afghanistan has caused them many more problems than it has been of any benefit.
Another interesting challenge for Pakistan, Pamela, is the fact that demographically it's an extremely young country. Is it half the population is children right now?
Well, certainly of teenagers, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, it's probably about half the population is under, you know, 17 or 16. And, you know, it's really a ticking time bomb. I mean, the demographic picture of Pakistan, it's a very fast-growing country. The birth rate is still much higher than, for example, India or Bangladesh or any of the surrounding developing countries. Family sizes are, you know, people marry young and they produce larger families, and when you pit that against the fact that there is simply not enough jobs, there simply are not enough jobs at any level for the population, not to mention education. I mean, most the literacy rates are quite low compared to, again, the surrounding countries with similar similar size and demographics. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really falling behind, and it's already unable to provide jobs and education for the majority of its citizens. And as it continues to grow in these next years, that situation is going to become worse and worse. Within 20 or 30 years, it's going to be the largest population, a Muslim country in the world. And it's also starting to run out of water. It's running out of electricity. There have been power shortages, major power shortages in all the cities over the past several years. Again, a ticking time bomb in which, you know, the ability of the state to support and educate and employ the citizens is very much in question.
Pamela Constable is with us. She's a foreign correspondent, former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. She's got a new book out called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We're also taking your emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Foreign correspondent Pamela Constable is with us from The Washington Post. Her new book is called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Pamela, before the break, you were describing some very serious potential issues in Pakistan, called the country a ticking time bomb. On the other hand, you would not characterize it as a failed state. What does it have working in its favor now, and what are the chances that Pakistan can hold on to the things that are working and expand upon them?
It's a very good question. You know, Pakistan has enormous potential. It always has. I mean, if you compare it to a place like Afghanistan, for example, which was destroyed by three decades of war, which has had a terrible drought for many, many years, which basically is still a tribal village country in ruins. Pakistan has, on paper at least, many, many more advantages. It has a very large administrative federal service that was set up by the British, as does India. It has, as we've said before, a very large professional army, one of the largest and most professional in the world. It has huge amounts of land with very good irrigation systems, and a very large workforce of people that are willing to work for low wages. It has a huge industrial sector. It produces all kinds of things, from cement to sugar to textiles. Its largest export is or are textiles and apparel. They export lots and lots of sheets and towels and shirts and socks and shoes, as well as other products, finished products. It's got all the political institutions, again, on paper, that would qualify it to be an important emerging democracy. It has a very old and distinguished court system. It has a parliament. It's had parliament ever since the beginning. It's had, obviously, an executive branch. It has, you know, many of the you tick off the box. A press. It has a vibrant, very expressive press. For example, it's got a fledgling but beginning to emerge a civic activist movement as well. So it's got all the, you know, all the many of the things that you would think that it would need to get ahead. But it's been plagued really since its almost since the beginning of its existence with poor leadership. And the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, died almost immediately after the triumph of his ability to be the founder of Pakistan. And then the second leader after that also died within a couple of years. And then since then, it's just been sort of one disaster after another. The military has intervened a number of times in the country's political life, as has the Supreme Court, as has the civilian president. You've had a number of leaders who either died or were killed in office. You've had the father of Benazir Bhutto, who was also killed. He was one of the most popular leaders the country ever had. He died, and he was accused of murder, and he was hung by the military, which then took power. And then, of course, you had Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated when she was trying to come back and run for office. So you've had a number of different kinds of leadership, periods of leadership, in which the country essentially, they got truncated and the country went back to square one. So most people that I talk to in Pakistan, when I ask them, you know, what is it that holds Pakistan back more than anything else, people point to what they call a lack of good leadership. You know, you've got an elite that essentially is pretty much thinking of itself rather than of the common man. You've never really had what you'd call a major land reform, which most other successful developing countries have had. You still have a lot of feudal patterns of land ownership as well as attitudes towards the poor. You have vast numbers of Pakistanis who cannot read and write, and essentially cannot contribute to the GNP in any way. So the reason I disagree with the notion of a failed state is because Pakistan has a very large functioning state that does many, many things. You know, you can go to an office and you can, you know, get your permit to do whatever it is you want to do, and, you know, it does function. The problem is that it doesn't function effectively for the majority of people. It functions effectively for itself. Many Pakistanis feel alienated from the state, feel abused by the state, feel they cannot get justice, feel they cannot get ahead in their lives. So in many ways, it's a state that has failed its people on some levels, even as it continues to function very effectively and efficiently in some areas.
Meanwhile, you have private citizens in Pakistan trying to do the right thing for the people. Can you tell us about Abdul Sadr Eddy?
Oh yes, my favorite Pakistani, and of course, one wishes there were more people like him everywhere. Abdul Sadr Eddy is an elderly gentleman. He's in his 80s, and he runs. He's famous for running a private ambulance service, the only free private ambulance service in the country. And he has ambulances all over the place in every city. And whenever there's a train wreck or a suicide bombing or something happens, you always see the little Edie ambulances running around. So that's what he became famous for. But But he's much more important than that. I mean, I would go as far as to call him sort of the moral conscience of the nation. I mean, he's this, you know, unrepentant, iconoclastic, you know, revolutionary old man who runs this extraordinary organization in his home city, which is Karachi, in which he has legions of mostly volunteers, some paid people, but mostly volunteers, who go out and help. And they don't only help the poor. His philosophy is not only to be a charity. His philosophy is to help empower the poor and help poor people get ahead. And so he has set up schools, all kinds of institutions for orphans and widows and drug addicts and, you know, all kinds of people who are cast out by the society. And he has worked with his wife and his followers, he really is almost like a cult leader in that sense, to help the poor of Pakistan feel like they can live a life of dignity and meaning. And it's a very classist society in which your rank, your social rank, matters a great deal. And he has always focused on the very lowest level of people. And he's always lived a very humble and modest life, not unlike Gandhi in India. And I have a sentence in the book where I say that Abdul Fattah Eady has always preached from an unassailable perch on the lowest rung of society.
It would seem like a figure like Eady could wield a great deal of political power. Has he involved himself deeply in politics and in electing leaders who would be more inclined to go along with the sorts of things he's trying to do?
Not really. I think he got involved in politics a number of years ago when he started out, but he left politics. I think he found it sort of too muddy, too unseemly, too corrupt, and he went off on his own and just has stayed very much in the realm of private charity ever since then. He's well known, though. He's traveled a lot. He's you know, one of the most popular people in Pakistan, and he's traveled widely abroad as well. But no, he has not. He's not spawned any sort of political movement or created a party or anything like that. He has many, many, many followers who admire him enormously and follow his example. But it has not really crossed the line into politics.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Altov on the line in Plano. Hi, Altov.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a couple of comments. It's a very good show, and I'm originally from Karachi. And having lived there, I was born just a year after Pakistan was created. My father would tell me some tales. And that, I think, reflects the reason why India and Pakistan didn't have good relations. Because in 1947, India didn't want Pakistan created, and the Indian government took a lot of adverse actions against Pakistan, such as not stopping the extremist group which blew up trains coming to Karachi, and also not releasing some of the assets that Pakistan was supposed to be given. And there were so many agreements signed that even Gandhi got frustrated. That's why he fasted, because he was trying to say to India that don't start a relationship on the wrong foot. So it was kind of like a bad divorce. But then I think we in the U.S. also have played a role in Pakistan's instability, that in the 1980s, we didn't think much about it. All we wanted to do was get rid of Soviet Union, but we didn't realize that we were going to drag Afghanistan and Pakistan into a big mess.
What do you think, Pamela?
Well, I think he makes some very good points. As we said earlier in the show, it was really that sort of chaotic birth of Pakistan that has never really been resolved. It's always lingered. That the trauma of that experience has always lingered in the society. And yes, definitely the war in Afghanistan had a similar effect. I mean, one of the great, great problems now for Pakistan is that people are so afraid that, you know, the West is again going to abandon them as they feel it did in 1989 after the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan and sort of left them at the mercy of all these problems. On the other hand, you know, we're not getting along at all at the moment, so most of the time they just say, get out of here, good riddance. But in the same breath, you know, they're very, very worried about being abandoned again by the West.
So we continue to pump large amounts of military aid into Pakistan, although I guess this week there was an announcement that funding would be cut by a third. Is that correct?
Yes, and it's there's also been a sort of a suspension or delay in some of the aid that is going to be coming. So there have been a number of measures taken, a number of statements made just to convey the current displeasure.
How would you evaluate the importance of military aid to Pakistan by the United States as compared with economic and humanitarian aid?
Not quite sure what you mean by the importance of, but certainly, I mean, you know, military aid has always been a large portion of the aid that has come. And in some cases, you know, it may well have been misused. It's been very hard to keep track of. You know, again, you know, you have the West, which sees the great enemy as, you know, Islamic terrorists, and Pakistan, which still essentially sees the great enemy as India. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem right there. But as I said before, the permanent imbalance between social and military spending has also been reflected in the use of aid. And I think that I know for a fact that American officials would like very much to see that change. And the Kerry Lugar package of aid, which was approved several years ago, would definitely have tried to redress that imbalance and also require a lot more monitoring of where the aid actually goes, which is one thing the Army was not very pleased about. But it remains a problem. You know, Pakistan, again, has always seen itself sort of as the underdog in always wants more military aid, when in fact what Pakistan really needs is more economic and social development.
Well, and without fully understanding the question, you answered it completely, because the question was essentially about, in terms of stabilizing the country, where are our dollars best applied?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else the international community and the U.S. specifically ought to be doing to bolster the democratic institutions within Pakistan and potentially at the same time weaken rogue militant groups?
Yeah, it's a very complicated issue. I mean, there's some things that you can't do. I mean, there's some problems that can only be addressed by literally, you know, getting rid of certain bad people. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just the way it is. But one hopes that if, you know, a few, you know, very notorious and violent leaders can actually be either, you know, killed or captured, then it would be possible to begin making larger changes and to help the country more in the way that it needs to be helped. I mean, education, I really think that the key is education. And if you just look at one tiny casualty of the war on terror, is that, you know, Pakistan used to have both American and British centers, educational centers, where anybody could literally walk in, read an American newspaper, read a book, take out a book, you know, see films about the United States, borrow music, you know, jazz, blues, you know, read Faulkner, just learn much more about America, and it was free, and of course, obviously, you had to have ID, but essentially, it was open to the public. Well, both the Americans and the British have had to shut down those centers and because of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to many Pakistanis who are slightly older, old enough to remember, who say to me, gosh, you know, and I remember when I was in college or when I was in high school, I used to go over to the American Center or over to the British Council after school just to read and to learn and to get a better sense of the world. You know, a lot of people miss that. And I'm not saying that, you know, exposure to Western thought automatically, you know, makes a country, you know, better in some way. Obviously, these countries have their own important histories and culture, but the openness and the exchange and the sense of being part of the global community, it's not there anymore, and I think that's terribly sad.
Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.